May it please the court, this is an open and shut appeal. Regardless of whether this court agrees with the Department of Revenue's position that the statute is unambiguous, or with the Kellenbrink's position that the statute is ambiguous, the result is the same. The Kellenbrink's are not allowed to obtain more than one tax credit. So this court can reverse for two different reasons. I'll begin first with the Kellenbrink's argument that the statute is ambiguous.
May I stop you for a moment? Because whether or not it's ambiguous is a question of law. So whatever their position is not binding on the court. The court has an obligation to affirm if, in fact, the decision is correct under the law. So why is their statement that it's ambiguous controlling?
It's not controlling, Your Honor. I start with this question only because the arguments here, under both arguments, our argument that the statute is unambiguous and their argument that the statute is ambiguous, both require ruling in favor of the Director of Revenue. That's why I start with their argument. But as this court has held dozens, if not hundreds, of times, when a tax credit statute is ambiguous, that ambiguity must be resolved in favor of taxation. Now, the Kellenbrinks argue that you should apply some sort of deferential canon for when an agency has issued a regulation or an interpretation in one direction. The problem with that argument, though, is those sorts of canons, those sorts of rules of construction, do not apply in the tax credit context. Instead, all ambiguity must be resolved in favor of taxation. And the reason is twofold. This principle stems from the rules of sovereign immunity. When the Kellenbrinks are arguing that the statute has ambiguously created a tax credit for them, they are in effect arguing that the legislature has ambiguously waived its sovereign immunity. But as this court has held time after time again, the legislature does not ambiguously waive its sovereign immunity. The legislature can only waive its sovereign immunity with express language clearly and unambiguously. And the second reason is because there's a long universal rule stemming back at least to the 1800s, where exceptions from default statutory schemes are construed narrowly. So we cited the U.S. against Allen case from the 1800s for that proposition and many other cases. So here the default taxation scheme in the state of Missouri is taxation on the entire purchase price of the vehicle purchased. The tax credit that they're seeking is an exemption from that default rule, so that exemption must be construed narrowly. The second reason this court can reverse is because the statute is unambiguous. Seven times in the statute uses the phrase the article, or in one situation, the original article. Now that is plainly and indisputably a singular phrase, as the Kellenbrinks admit. That's why the Administrative Hearing Commission on 17 different occasions has had no trouble in determining that this statute is unambiguous. It allows one credit and one credit only. Now, the Kellenbrinks point to a different provision of the statute that does use plural language. It says motor vehicles, plural. But when you're looking at that in context of the seven instances where the statute plainly uses the singular term, the article or the original article, it's clear that the phrase, the reference to motor vehicles, plural, is discussing the class of different vehicles.
Well, the plural appears in the controlling sentence of the statute, does it not?
It appears right before the term, the original article, which is singular.
And so, the original article falls within the portion of that sentence that refers to timing. Would that be correct?
It does refer to both those provisions, the motor vehicles and the original article, fall within that same section of the statute.
And that's the controlling sentence. Is that right?
The part that refers to motor vehicles and the original article is the controlling sentence. The part that discusses a subsequent purchase or a purchase before or after 100 days, that's a separate timing provision. The Administrative Hearing Commission said that was separate. The Kellenbrinks say that is, quote-unquote, extrinsic to the text that actually matters. So the reference to motor vehicles, plural, and the original article, singular, makes clear that motor vehicles refers to the class of vehicles from which a taxpayer can designate one single original article to use as a credit.
If in fact, the legislature intended the opposite, if it intended to to allow application of proceeds from the sale of multiple motor vehicles, wouldn't it be necessary to limit the beginning of the 180 days time period to one event rather than the sale of each of those vehicles? So wouldn't the date of sale of the original article be the starting date of that 180 days?
Well, I think that what the statute is getting at, and the answer is no, and the reason is that the statute is getting at the sort of situation where a person may sell a vehicle with no intent to buy a later vehicle and then decide 180 days or fewer days after that to buy a vehicle. Then the statute allows that person the sort of transactional flexibility to use that original sale that happened beforehand or an original sale that happened afterward to obtain one tax credit against the purchase price of the replacement vehicle.
But if, in fact, we give effect to the plural in the beginning of that sentence, which refers to it applies to motor vehicles, trailers, boats, and other outboard motors sold by the owner, then the original article would begin the 180 days, and so it would apply to any sales that occur within 180 days after the sale of the original one of the original motor vehicle, trailer, boat, et cetera.
I think it's 180 days before or after the purchase of the replacement vehicle. So you can sell a different vehicle 180 days before that or 180 days after that. Again, to the extent there's any ambiguity about the use of the term subsequent and before or after, we think that ambiguity is resolved in one instance because subsequent has multiple different meanings, which we discussed in the reply or in the opening brief. And second, because that phrase, as the Kellenbrinks admit, is extrinsic. It is separate from the phrase that matters. And extrinsic phrases, extrinsic factors, cannot inject ambiguity into the text that the Administrative Hearing Commission 17 times has determined is unambiguous.
Can you address the regulation and how long it's been in effect?
Yes, the regulation has been in effect since 2006. The statute predates that regulation by many, many decades. And the government did make a mistake here. It should not have issued that regulation. That regulation is invalid because, as this court has stated many different times in the Union Electric case, the Lynn against Director of Revenue case, and many other cases, a regulation cannot broaden the scope of a statute. So here the government did make an error, and it is in the process of rescinding that statute. Now, it hasn't rescinded that statute beforehand because the regulation is rescinding the regulation. It hasn't rescinded the regulation beforehand because it's never been a problem. Again, every single time until this Administrative Hearing Commission's decision, every single time the Administrative Hearing Commission decided that the statute was unambiguous.
But isn't it somewhat the common practice around the state to allow multiple credits to sell of multiple vehicles? And if so, how does that play into, you know, a reasonable person's interpretation of the statute and the regulation?
So again, that would be an extrinsic factor. So that extrinsic factor cannot inject ambiguity into the statute. This court said that in Wolf Shoe, quote, a statute cannot be made ambiguous by administrative interpretation. And this court many different times have rejected arguments that the director's interpretation, that the director should be stopped from imposing a taxation statute because of a previous incorrect interpretation. It is the statute that controls. That's the Lynn against Director of Revenue case. The statute controls. The regulation does not control. Erroneous interpretations by the Director of Revenue do not control.
In common practice does not play into your analysis?
Correct. It is the statute that controls. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Scott Kellenbrink. I represent David and Jill Kellenbrink, the respondents in this case. And I'd like to explain to you, Your Honors, why the court can affirm the Administrative Hearing Commission decision in this case. And as correctly noted already, ambiguity is obviously a question of law, which you have the ability to make that determination. I'd like to explain to you why we believe that the statute is ambiguous. The director has argued in their brief that ambiguity is not present on the face. It's simple that we disagree with that. The commission made a finding to the contrary of that. The commission made that finding as the result of the contradictory terms subsequent and the phrase before or after in the same portion of the statute.
Well, what about that? It's 144.025.1 says the section shall apply to motor vehicles sold by the owner if the seller purchases or contracts to purchase a subsequent motor vehicle. Why doesn't that A limit it to one? It doesn't say any. Nobody seems to talk about that, but A to me means one.
Because, Your Honor, I believe that the subsequent motor vehicle, a subsequent motor vehicle, in that sense, refers back to this plural phrasing of the motor vehicles, trailers, boats, and with the conjunctive term outboard motors. And so I believe that the use of a subsequent also creates somewhat of an ambiguity within that entire scheme.
Isn't the rule that that an ambiguity is construed against the taxpayer where we're dealing with an exemption?
Your Honor, I would say that that is the rule with a clarification. It must be construed reasonably. It's not an automatic win, as I believe.
Well, if it's ambiguous, then you're admitting there's more than one reasonable interpretation. Otherwise, it wouldn't be ambiguous.
Yes, ma'am. And what the commission did, which I think is proper in this case, is to attempt some statutory construction of the ambiguity. They look, when we have an ambiguity, our intent, our main goal is to determine legislative intent. And so I've advanced in my writings to this court the evidence of the legislative intent. That includes a prior version of this statute, which is very informative to what I believe the legislative intent is. And in the context of in 1998, the legislature removed the word replacement vehicle and inserted that word we just discussed, subsequent motor vehicle.
So they changed it so you can buy the vehicle before or after the sale.
Well, the director's argument, ma'am, is that subsequent in this sense means place and it doesn't mean time. And frankly, I disagree with that because I don't think that the ordinary meaning of subsequent is place.
If I agree with you on that, I still don't understand why a subsequent motor vehicle doesn't limit it to one.
Because
it doesn't say any or all, it says a.
I believe that it's the same analysis with respect to their argument on the singular term of original article. The original article in the singular referring back to a plural phrase and a plural and conjunctive phrase is creating that ambiguity. And so then when we go to evaluate and clarify this ambiguity by using the evidence that we have to determine the legislative intent, then it's, in my mind, it becomes clear. I think the court has the right and frankly, the duty to determine the legislature's intent when viewing, if they find an ambiguity. I think there is an ambiguity. So therefore, we need to look at the legislature's intent. We see what I have advanced in my arguments, which is the prior version of the bill.
Would we have to overrule prior cases saying where it's ambiguous, we construe it narrowly, and where it's unambiguous, then there's no construction involved at all?
Well, I don't believe so, Judge. I don't think that you would have to necessarily overrule that. I think that the cases that are informative on this do not deal with companion regulations as we have here. And so the court is left to interpreting the statutory language just on its face. And they've done that in some of these cases like Stockholm and Spurgeon. Now, those are not tax cases, and I understand that. But when there is a non-companion regulation, they don't find an ambiguity and simply say, that's the end of the analysis. We have to construe it against the taxpayer. They use the canons of statutory construction to try and determine the legislature's intent. We have more than just the wording of that statute here in order to help us determine that intent. And we haven't even discussed those extrinsic factors which go to the ambiguity.
Well, how does that change in language support your construction?
How does what?
The change in language from the prior statute to this one, how does that support more than that you could sell your vehicle before or after the new purchase?
Yes, ma'am. Our argument is that, it goes to the number of credits more than the timing necessarily, but when they, let me get the, so the prior version of the bill was this section shall also apply to motor vehicles, et cetera, sold by the owner if the seller purchases a replacement motor vehicle. In 1998, they removed that language, replacement motor vehicle, and inserted subsequent motor vehicle. It's my argument, Your Honor, that the word replacement more closely indicates a one-for-one scenario where the owner sells one motor vehicle and replaces it with another. And I would add that in the respondent's initial argument this morning, he actually answered a question by defining or explaining the word subsequent by using the word replacement. And I think that illustrates the fact that the legislature specifically removed that word because they don't intend it to be a replacement.
What is your strongest authority for your position that if there is an original ambiguity in a statute, the court doesn't immediately determine that that ambiguity is resolved in favor of the government, that instead the court applies the general rules of construction, and only if they don't resolve the ambiguity is the statute interpreted in favor of the taxing authority?
In the tax context, Your Honor, I don't believe that there is written opinion in case law on that point. However, I think that we can look at the case advanced by the respondent, which is the Fidelity Life case, which he uses to support that that proposition. And actually, I don't think it supports that proposition, because in Fidelity Life, this is one of those cases where they did not have a companion regulation. Fidelity Life dealt with a deduction, a carryover deduction. The taxpayer had already received a deduction or a credit in the prior year, and they wanted to carry over what they had remaining in the next year. And so the court looked to see whether there was an ambiguity in the statute. The court did find an ambiguity in the statute, but what it did was it used a canon of construction to determine the intent purely from the language of the statute. They did not have a regulation to consult. And so what they did was they said the legislature used this phrase at another point in the statute and demonstrated that they knew how to allow for this carryover. And in the statute, in the portion of the statute which the case came under, the legislature did not use that specific language. And so they said, we assume, because the legislature has demonstrated that they know how to use that term and allow for a carryover in another section, that they intentionally left it out in the latter section, and therefore it's their intent to not provide for that carryover. They didn't say, ambiguity, here it is, we're done, you lose, taxpayer. I also think that and admittedly, this is without support, but I also think that there's a public policy element to that immediate disclosure or foreclosure, I should say, in this case, given all of the other evidence that we have to show the intent and also the regulation. The regulation, in my mind, is a major element. There's there's examples. You know, the director does not take issue with the fact that his regulation is wrong. I think as a matter of public policy, it's difficult for us to find it okay to allow the director to abandon that regulation at this moment in time when that regulation has been in force and effect since 2006.
Can the director issue regulations that are inconsistent with the statute and this court must apply them because, gosh, they're issued? I mean, don't we have to look at whether it was within the director's authority?
whether it was in the director's what?
If your argument could be applied so that there would be no limit on the regulations that could be adopted, and even if they're clearly, you don't think this one is, but if they're clearly outside the scope of the statute, do we nonetheless have to follow them?
No, Your Honor. We admit that the statute controls, but in this case, when the director specifically issues a regulation with the stated purpose of explaining the application of sales tax on motor vehicles as it pertains to 144.025, they've now put out for public use, and when someone goes to the statute and finds an ambiguity, a person of ordinary intelligence can do that, I believe, and then the regulation is there for reference. The director doesn't make issue with the fact that the government, in this case, issued a wrong regulation, and it remains wrong, and it remains adverse to what their current interpretation of the statute is. And I would also like to mention that the repeated references to the prior Administrative Hearing Commission decisions, they don't have any, they are not binding on this court whatsoever, and the commission itself, in its opinion, admits that they have no precedential authority. I would advance to you that review of those prior AHC commission decisions reveals an unrepresented plaintiff where the director has filed a motion for summary determination and no response to that summary determination was ever filed.
To the extent you're saying we should defer to agency expertise, though, in the regulation, is that counterbalanced by these admittedly totally non-precedential agency interpretations in those 17 cases?
I'm not sure I understand your question, Your Honor.
That's all right. Go ahead. Okay. Don't have much time left.
Counsel, can you respond to the state's argument about the narrow waiver of sovereign immunity? I mean, isn't such a narrow waiver to be construed strictly?
Your Honor, I believe that the statute that we're dealing with, Section 144, specifically authorizes this action, and I believe that it's 144.190, which comes later in the statutory scheme, obviously, and says that if any tax has been erroneously collected, the balance with interest shall be refunded to the person. I think that is as specific as we can get as far as an intention to waive the sovereign immunity that the director argues. So that would be our argument on that point. I would, with the short period of time that I have remaining, I would just summarize by saying that we believe an ambiguity is present, although there is law to suggest that those ambiguities in a taxpayer situation need to be construed strictly against the taxpayer. They also need to be construed reasonably against that party claiming the exemption. That's the Rawlings versus Shipman case from 2011, which is contained in my brief. And I think the reasonable analysis, when we really dive into the legislative intent, what we have to review, the prior bill version, the regulation, and some of those extrinsic factors which point us, you know, I admit that those extrinsic factors are not instructive or binding on this court, but they are highly persuasive, at least to the issue of ambiguity, those being the improper evaluation and instruction from the director's own agent, and the fact that the director allowed more than one credit already on this transaction, which they admit was wrong. And so I would conclude with that, unless there are further questions for me, and I appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you.
May it please the court. The Kellenbrinks have conceded that they have no tax case in their favor on this situation, and that is because this court has held dozens, if not hundreds of times, that any ambiguity must be resolved in favor of taxation. Now, to the extent they rely on Section 144.190 to say that the legislature has waived its sovereign immunity, that's putting the cart before the horse. All that statute does is says that if they are entitled to a tax credit, then they get a refund. But here, the question is whether they are entitled to a tax credit. The granting of a tax credit is itself a waiver of sovereign immunity. The legislature can only do that unambiguously. To the extent there is ambiguity, sovereign immunity bars the obtainment of a tax credit. I think it's important to look at what the standard they have to meet is. This court has repeatedly said that to obtain a tax credit, the plaintiff bears the burden of showing that it is, quote unquote, perfectly clear that they are entitled to a tax credit from the statute. When a statute is ambiguous, it is not perfectly clear that they are entitled to a tax credit. In other courts, this court has said they have to prove their entitlement by clear and unequivocal proof. Looking at that and comparing that to an ambiguous statute, it's very clear what the difference is between the position they're asserting right now, which is that the statute is ambiguous, and the position they would have needed to assert in order to prevail. Now, as to their invocation of the statute before 1998, they've admitted that this separate timing provision is extrinsic, regardless of whether there is ambiguity in this separate timing provision. An extrinsic factor cannot inject ambiguity into the text. This court has said that many times. The BASF Corps against Director of Revenue case from 2012, this court said, a statute is ambiguous when its plain language does not answer the current dispute as to its meaning. Wolf Shoe Company, many other cases, this court says that ambiguity is determined based on the text alone. As for the companion regulations, it's not true that this is the first case where there has been a companion regulation in dispute in a case where there's arguments about ambiguity. The Union Electric Company case is a prime example. There was a dispute about whether a bakery could use a tax exemption statute for the processing of a product. And in fact, the regulation said that a bakery was exempt from sales tax in that situation for electricity. And there, the Director of Revenue conceded in its brief, as we've done here, that the regulation was unlawful to the extent that it was interpreted as the plaintiff had interpreted it. And this court said, again, as it should say here, a regulation cannot expand the scope of the statute. So unless this court has any further questions, we ask that this court reverse the Administrative Hearing Commission's decision.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.